Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the mega city metropolis of Toronto. I'm your host, Eric Anthony. Thank you for tuning in. This is the first episode of 2021, and it's going to be a good one. I have welcoming back to the Cave of Solitude one of my favorite guests and one of my favorite creators coming out of our city. He's worked on Ogres. He's the writer and artist of Terraquill, the artist of Samurai Grandpa. He's getting quite a bibliography in these last couple of years. It's none other than Mr. Sean Daly. Sean, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Good, good, man. Thanks for having me back on the chat. It's been a little while.
It has been. Yes, yeah, we got a lot to catch up on. The last time we spoke, it was just at the beginning of all of this lockdown stuff, and unfortunately, it seems like we're still in the same spot, but how have you been doing?
Yeah, not much has changed.
Yeah,
not bad, not bad. I'm pretty fortunate, you know, because I just get to wake up and just draw my days away mostly. Well, and if not that, then it's music, but it's all stuff that I can do from home.
Right.
So I'm fortunate about that. Things are still a little bit, you know, slower than I remember them being, which makes a lot of sense. And, you know, just taking it day by day, pretty much.
That's good. Well, it's good that you're able to stay home and be busy with, one, pursuits that you enjoy, but also are paying the bills, which not many people can say, but I'm happy that you stayed busy work-wise this last couple of years, because everything's been up in the air for a lot of people, so.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it hasn't been a walk in the park. I guess it never really is, but it's been a lot less of one this last year.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm very thankful that I can, you know, keep my head down and stay busy.
Yeah, absolutely. And you were working on a bunch of different things last year around March or April when we last spoke in 2020. And there was a lot of things that at the time you couldn't get into too much detail of what you could talk about because things hadn't been announced yet or whatnot. But I'm hoping, well, I know one of those things with the new Kickstarter that you announced. It's going to be the Bridge Builder's Creed. I'm really looking forward to that. Tell me about what is in store for people who are fans of yours or people who have been waiting for a follow-up, because it was a mini comic that you made of the Bridge Builder's Creed, right?
Yeah, like the whole thing just started off as just doing some more mini comics, just kind of like the way I did Terraquill, which was just these very short, like 22 to 30 page self-published, self-printed comics.
Mm-hmm.
But as were the Terraquill books were like short stories, this one is a full long 170 page graphic novel. So it's a little bit different than what I was doing before, but I just wanted to try something long form, because Terraquill was very much like a way to get accustomed to writing and drawing comics. So I started with short stories for that. And now this is my take on something much larger than just that.
So when did this idea, I know that you had the mini comic, so, you know, the idea has been out there for a little bit, but to make it a full on 170 plus page graphic novel, where did that inspiration come from that you said, I'm going to go all the way with this story?
Well, I knew that I wanted to do something like this back, even while I was working on Terraquill.
Okay.
But I knew that I should start a little smaller. Like, why not? Why, you know, learn how to swim in the ocean when you can, like, you know, swim in like a swimming pool with a lifeguard there and stuff like that. So I had just started off really small, just doing kind of very short stories. And then, you know, I always knew that I wanted to write something a lot longer and something long form. And then after I finished Terraquill, I just felt like, okay, I kind of got my feet wet, so I can, you know, now work on something bigger. So actually, while I was doing the Kickstarter for Terraquill, I was writing this book now.
Mm.
And, you know, 5 years later, it's finally ready to go.
So is this, I've read the Bridge Builder's Creed, and I've never been able to get my hands on Terraquill copy, because every time I've gone to the cons, they've always been out of stock on them. So is this a follow-up? Is this a sequel to it in a way, a spiritual sequel?
Yeah, like this takes place in the same world, the same land, Terraquill, for sure.
Right.
And if you've read, well, First of all, I'll make sure to get you a copy the next time I see you.
Yes.
Make sure I have one for you, because I do have some I can hand off. But if anyone has read Terrorquill, there is going to be, you know, a bit of crossover. You're going to see some characters who are familiar in the Bridge Builders Creed. But if you haven't, that's fine. You don't absolutely need to. It's just a little something extra for anyone who has. So it's not technically a sequel, but it does take place in the same world. And, you know, I do plan on releasing more books in the same world as well. It's just so much fun for me to, you know, write and draw some weird stuff in a world where I kind of get to create all the rules, you know.
Right. So the world of Terrorquill, can you explain it to those of us who haven't read that universe specifically that you created whole cloth, and what can they expect with the new story that you've got coming out?
Well, it's a hard world to describe. It was very influenced by like fables, like a lot of weird mythological beings and creatures, and also really influenced by like Dr. Seuss as well. It's just kind of this very strange fantasy world that isn't really all that far off from our own in some areas of it. But I guess if you were going to go into the Bridge Builders Creed without having read any of the other Terrorquill stuff, you wouldn't really need a whole lot. Like, it's all kind of set up in the first few pages of the book, and there's actually going to be a whole bunch of world building stuff in the back of the book as well. Just fun things from, you know, like my binders and binders of ideas that didn't quite make the cut for the books, but that I wanted to talk about anyhow. So yeah, all that stuff will be in there.
That's exciting. Will the Kickstarter have an option to buy Terrorquill as well as the Bridge Builders Creed?
It won't, just because I don't have enough. I don't have any copies. Like, I have a couple, but not enough that would facilitate like an entire reward tier for them.
Okay.
But I know that SourcePoint Press hopefully should have a bunch of copies available online. But, you know, having said that, man, do I ever miss conventions and just being able to, you know, walk to the tables and just pick up stuff as you see it. Like,
yeah. There's something about that, right? I mean, even going to my comic book shop a few weeks ago to pick up a couple books, one, with all of the distribution kind of up in the air, whether it be DC deciding who's distributing their books or even just things coming in late because of the circumstances, you realize that curbside pickup is not going to sustain a lot of these businesses that involve you actually being able to touch and see what's on a shelf. Because a lot of times, I mean, I was at the front of the store. They have like a little table there set up. You're waiting in the cold, which is uncomfortable. But then like, anything else you need? And it's like, I can't even look at the menu of what you guys got right now, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's a very good reason that comic shops all have, you know, racks and shelves that display the cover of a book, because you want to be able to look at something and just pick it up and see what it's all about. But yeah, you're not really getting that right now. So yeah, it's definitely not going to sustain.
No.
But you know, hopefully we'll have the proper solutions coming into effect sooner than we hope. That's, you know.
For sure. I think everybody at this point is on board for, I hope the majority is on board for accommodating a solution as well, because as frustrating as everything can be, I think we're all really itching to go back to some sense of normalcy where at least we can go places again and see each other again without always, it almost is like we're kind of looking over our shoulder now wondering, is this a good idea or not? And I think we're all ready for this to end.
You know, I'm glad that most of the people I know are being, you know, safe and really, you know, taking it seriously and stuff. That's like, I'm super glad that I can say that. But yeah, absolutely. I'm we're all looking forward for this to end so we can move on and kind of return to some semblance of normalcy at least.
Yeah. How did you deal with not having cons this year? Because I know for you, it's not only something that you enjoy the interaction with people, but it is a form of income for you. And you also seem like a person who's just a fan who enjoys being at these things. How did you get through that no con season, no con year, drought that we've had?
Yeah.
What did you do?
Absolutely. I don't know. I have no idea. I've just been keeping busy with work. Like, that's honestly...
That's good.
Been one of the big things that has been getting me through this is just enjoying comics in the best ways that I can, which is making them and reading them, even though, there are so many people at these conventions that I would see every single year. And to not be able to see them for like a full year is just, honestly, it sucks. Like, there are so many cool, interesting people that would come by my table. And, you know, we would talk about our families and about just our lives and about work and stuff. Like, these complete, these people who I only would see once or twice a year, you know, and having a year of not seeing them really totally sucks. But, I kind of just remind myself that, hey, this is, you know, as long as we just continue being safe and take care of ourselves, this is a temporary thing and we will be able to move past it. And, it's just a matter of time. I hope. I really hope.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think we're turning the corner and, you know, I think the finish line is in sight, but it's always the last little bit, right? That last rep when you do an exercise, that last turn of the corner is always the hardest to get to, right?
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where you would appreciate the reference to wrestling, where we're almost at that point where the referee tells us to go home.
Yeah, we're almost at the go home note. Yeah.
But usually,
I mean, I hope so.
Yeah, usually at that point, the guys are on the mat panting, and you're wondering if they can even live through the next couple minutes to finish the match. And that's what it feels like now, right? It just seems like, man, did we think it would get to this point? But it's almost that go-home time. It's almost time.
Almost. Yeah, almost. It's, yeah, you can kind of see the finish line. Just got to tough it out and keep going, keep being safe, keep looking after each other. So
yeah,
hopefully soon, yeah.
What did you find? I know a couple of I've heard writers. One of them I had mentioned to Ricky Lima was Neil Gaiman, and I know that Ricky had experienced something similar in regards to staying inspired. Did you ever go through some bouts of finding that inspiration, or is it just being able to put your head down and work is what is good enough for you?
Oh no! Every day I have struggles finding the inspiration to. You know, it's maybe it's an artist thing, I don't know, or like a creative thing, mm-hmm. rather, where, you know, it's so easy to just to not find the inspiration that you need, or to be, you know, kind of racked with self-doubt. And I think the important thing isn't to, you know, like, obviously we're going to feel that way from time to time.
Of course.
But for me, what's helped is just kind of not fighting it, just saying, like, you know what, this is a phase. I have to kind of accept that I'm feeling this way and acknowledge it. Maybe take a bit of time to do something else, and then that feeling will pass, or I'll just kind of naturally find the inspiration that I'm looking for by just moving on with my life and doing something else for a few hours, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I totally feel that way. It's just kind of a matter of figuring out how to deal with it in, you know, the best way that I can.
So what strategies do you have to help you get over that hump?
I'll kick back for a little bit and either read one of the books that I'm on, or I'll play some video games for a little while, or maybe make some music, or just kind of do anything else, really. Even like have a nap, just something that isn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And then I find that, you know, once I take that time and kind of be okay with it, then the inspiration that I'm looking for will pop up sooner or later, or the motivation that I'm looking for. But one thing that I've learned this year is kind of the power of just like rest and being okay with taking it easy. And you know, knowing when to take breaks and stuff like that. That's been a huge help.
I think that's great advice, actually, because I think now, especially with how common remote working has become for a lot of people. I know for artists such as yourself and a lot of our mutual friends, they're used to working in solitude. They're used to working in their own little, you know, cave of solitude, if you will. No pun intended, but I guess it works. Yeah. But that's normal. But for a lot of other folks who are used to going to an office and having their desk and their workspace where they do things, now they've had to create that in, you know, spaces at home where they live in a space maybe in the city where there isn't a room for them to establish an office or whatnot, and they never get away from work. I know my parents and some of my friends, like, work is, we're always at work. It feels like we're putting in more hours, we're more tired, and they don't know how to shut it off. So
that was me for a really long time, and it still is. I'm still trying to figure out that balance, but I'm better than I was a year ago, so I can at least say that. But yeah, it's hard to sometimes shut it down and just kind of like tune out for a little bit from the things that you're doing and rest properly.
Yeah,
but it's something that I couldn't go back to the way I was working before. It's kind of like, you know, I found that even when I'm well rested and I'm taking breaks, I'm able to think clearly, and I'm way more productive. So,
yeah,
you know, only good things have come from that. It just took a while to learn.
That's good, though. I think that's something everyone needs to hear reinforced and to really – it's almost like – sounds silly to say, but you've got to make sure – the same way we had to make sure before we had to go to work or go grocery shopping, we need to make sure that we take our breaks and we shut down work when it needs to be shut down. Because we won't be effective otherwise. And I find with what you said, as you're an artist in music and also writing and drawing, it's nice to hear that even people who seem to always be creative go through those moments too, you know?
For sure. Yeah. I hope it, I hope somebody's listening and they're like, yeah, you know what? I'm going to take a break right now.
Let me shut off this podcast. Let me
get us a break. Phil.
Yeah. You're, to be completely honest with you, and I'm not saying it's because you're on the show, you're one of the more inspiring people that I've met in my life, because you are doing something in regards to comics that I think about that first time we hung out together, and you said that you just picked it up because somebody bought you an art set. And yep. I think of where you are now in regards to people knowing your work and you becoming an artist, like a real official professional artist from just picking up as a hobby. I think that's so inspiring, because so many people say, why bother? I'm not going to be good at it. What's the point? And I mean, you buck all those trends. I think that's awesome when you see people do that. What inspires you? That's what I want to know. What inspires you?
What inspires me is, are all the, well, a lot of the books and the creative people who I follow.
Mm-hmm.
So yesterday was portfolio day on social media, Twitter, to be exact. And man, the stuff that people were posting from all the artists, the writers, the editors, the letters, the colorists, everyone was just posting this amazing work. And when I put on like my feed or have a look at all that stuff, it just, that's the kind of stuff that makes, that gets me motivated and makes me say, oh man, like I want to be a part of this community that's making such amazing art, and not just like visual art, but you know, the way that people are writing, the way that people are working together. So the community itself, like the worldwide comic community, is a huge place that I get a lot of inspiration and motivation from. And if it's not that, then it's probably something that I'm reading or something that I'm watching or just the art that I'm consuming in my life through other means.
Right. Okay, so let's build on that. What was the last thing perhaps that you read that inspired or motivated you to create yourself? Was there some album, a television show, comic book?
Well, right now I'm reading a book series called The Stormlight Archive by Brandon Sanderson, I believe his name is. It's just this amazing, super high concept fantasy series. And I'm only in the second book, but reading the way that he's built his world and his magic systems and stuff is just such a huge, like, it's making me want to sit down and write another book, which that has started, but I'm definitely taking a lot of inspiration from him. I got through Ghost of Tsushima on PlayStation, and that game was just like, oh man, I don't know if you've heard of or played this game at all.
No.
No, it's a samurai game.
Okay.
I have a thing for samurais. I've written and drawn a couple samurai stories in my time. So, playing this just really got me super motivated. Actually, as soon as I had finished the game a couple of days ago, I sent a message to Easton DiVerna, the writer of Samurai Grandpa, and I was like, oh man, you got to play this game. We got to sit down and like talk more about the Samurai Grandpa follow-up that we're doing. And I was just very excited after beating that game to move on to some of my own creative stuff. So, you know, there's always something, you know.
Do you ever feel some, because this happens for some, I know it's happened for me sometimes, when you see people who you're trying to not compete with, but you're in a creative endeavor similar to theirs, and they do something that makes you say, why do I even bother? Does that ever happen to you?
Yeah, every day.
Okay.
every day I see somebody who's putting out this, either an amazing idea for a book or just this wild artwork, and I look at it, I'm like, wow, where do I fit in if this is what people are releasing, you know? But that's always a fleeting thing. That's always just a temporary thought before I kind of reality check myself and, you know, get out of that. Because that's such an unproductive mindset, you know? Like, you can't go your whole career feeling like that about everything that you look at, despite how good what you're looking at is. But also, it's probably healthy to feel that way a little bit, because you get a little bit of motivation from that when you're looking at other people's work and, you know, questioning your own. But yeah, no, that's something I do every day, and trying not to, but, you know, good luck.
Yeah, I think about that sometimes, and even if you just kind of look at what people doing with life, you know, the choices people make, oh, that guy's married, oh, that guy started his own business, where am I in life? We always kind of compare and contrast to kind of measure ourselves, but it could go two ways, that moment, and you could either become jealous, and that'll take you down a road that makes you maybe competitive or ready to tear down, or it could also be the same seed that grows into an inspiration, and it just makes you want to try. Not so much
absolutely
worry about the jealousy aspect, but you can be inspired. So it's always interesting to see how other artists combat those feelings, because they've got, you know, a vision. Like, I want to put out this book. I've got this idea. I just want to do it. And it's so refreshing to see how people work through that and combat those demons, if you will.
For sure, yeah. And I think the important thing to take away is that, like, everyone feels like that.
Yeah.
You know, like, you don't have to think that, you know, you're alone when you're feeling like that. That's just the thing. Like, everybody feels that way sometimes.
Yeah.
And it's okay, you know?
What was the, when you started, you know, being an artist, what was the biggest, I guess, intimidation moment that you remember experiencing as a new guy on the scene, if you will? Because were you an artistic at all in your teenage years, your early 20s?
I tried to be. I was more of a musician.
Right.
Like, I was in and out of bands and recording albums and stuff like that. So in a way I was, but nothing to do with comics or visually, really.
Yeah, yeah. Visual arts is in that regard, yeah.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I didn't really, there was no moments where I really like kind of fell out of my element.
Mm.
And the reason is just because like everyone was so nice when I was getting into, like comics and figuring out how to make them and learning how to draw. The industry that I came from, which is music and recording, there are a lot of people who made me want to, not made me, but just being around them didn't make me want to stay in that business. You know what I mean?
Hmm.
You know, there's like a lot of hostility and over competitiveness in that industry when I was in it, at least. And the first thing I noticed about comics was like that didn't seem to translate. I wasn't having to deal with egos or, you know, people who are overtly competitive to a point where they're just impossible to work with. Everyone is super cool. And that was one of the things that made me want to like keep working in the business. And not to say that, oh, the business doesn't have its problems. It certainly does. But when I was first getting started, I didn't notice anything immediately that made me kind of nervous or worried about it, I guess.
Why do you think that is? I mean, like you said, it has its own set of, you know, every industry has its own set of politics that comes around. But why do you, so yeah, I mean, I interrupted you. You don't know. It just felt that way.
No. I have no idea why that is. And at first I thought, oh, it's got to be a regional thing. It's got to be a Toronto thing. And then I did cons not only in the States, but like overseas. And like everyone is so nice. It just seemed to be, I don't know, maybe it's because we're all kind of misfits in a way that, we read these books with pictures in them that a lot of, you know, mainstream society, at least, maybe not lately, but for a long time, considered kids' books, and that you're a little, different for simply even just like reading these books. So we all kind of have felt that way before, maybe growing up, and we don't want to keep feeling that way when we're older, so we don't act, you know, we don't treat people that way. I don't know. It's such a hard thing to figure out, but it's not native to Toronto, that's for sure.
That's so refreshing to hear, because I haven't traveled to any cons. Well, I went to New York actually for Mocha Fest, but I haven't gone to any cons really outside of Ontario. And
right.
You're right. The community is friendly. Even just for me being a podcaster, how generous people are with their time and some of the friendships that have been formed just from because we love comics. And like you said, there's that misfit aspect in regards to we're all kind of different. And that's what we like about each other. So we're all kind of different, yeah. But the same.
For sure. Yeah. We all kind of have. Well, we all have a love for comics, so yeah. Right there, we're all, you know, I don't know one person who is getting into comics to have money and fame.
That's
true. Whereas when I was in the music industry, that was like 75% of why people wanted to do music. It wasn't necessarily for a love of music. It was because they wanted music videos and they wanted to work with certain big name producers and they wanted nice cars and stuff like that. And I haven't met like one person. I can pretty much guarantee I haven't met a single person who only wants to do comics for those reasons.
Yeah, there is a, I think you're right. There are musicians who want to make hits and be popular and be liked. And then you've got those who want to be true artists who are on the other side of the spectrum. But in comics, I think everybody takes their, because your work is on full display all the time. And you feel like everyone can maybe see your faults or, you know, you're going to ruin someone's childhood. So you take the work seriously, even if everyone hates it, your intention was to not do something bad.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. I think with music people, you know, some people know the formula to make a song catchy. They don't really care if it's actually good. But I think in comics, I think maybe I'm wrong, but everybody wants they want to pay respect to the art form.
That's what it seems like, yeah. That's exactly what it seems like. And I think, you know, the industry is obviously like way better off for it for reasons like that.
Yeah. It's one of those things where, with music, you can, I mean, you understand this better than even myself. A lot of people can have their hands in it when it's something that could be a commodity. Whereas when you are writing a book or telling a story, you really want that story to be something that, even if it's not a top seller, will come back. In comics, it seems like the good quality stuff lives forever, regardless of what the title was. If it was an Image comic, it'll make its rounds again. Like I think of Rick Remender with Fear Agent. And it was a book that he could barely publish, and now it's got, you know, multiple printings from every company that could get their hands on it. So I think that happens with comics a lot of times.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that's absolutely right.
With your art style, was it just something that organically happened, or was there a feel that you wanted your art to evoke that helped you develop your tone, your colors, your everything that you do?
First, when I was just getting started, I knew that I wanted to mimic a few of my favorite artists.
And okay.
I would kind of look at their styles and try and draw in similar styles and just ask questions as to why they might have made certain choices that they made, or, you know, what. Just try to really break down the art almost in a scientific way, where I could, you know, really have an interesting look at it and just ask, like, why are they making these decisions? What? And it wasn't until much later on, like a few years after I started drawing, that I realized, like, you can do that all day, every day, and, you know, yeah, maybe you'll learn some techniques, but you're not going to learn how to do anything unique by looking at their work. You kind of have to just maybe approach things a little bit differently and try things that you've never tried or come up with your own ideas. And ever since I started approaching art like that, I've had not only a lot more fun drawing, but I feel like I've kind of come into my own a little bit.
Yeah.
I hope so.
Who are some of those artists that in the beginning you were drawn to in regards to, you know, imitating and being inspired by?
Well, I've always loved the work of guys like Jeff Lemire and Matt Kent, because they have a very emotional way of drawing. It's almost, it looks very, almost like European inspired, of just you know, ink washes and very interesting line work. A lot of wispy kind of unsteady lines, which I just love. Like, they have so much character to them. So I had started off with guys like that and cartoonists like that. And then as time went on, I started to remember, you know, all of the artists I grew up loving when I was a kid, but I never really realized how much of an impact they had on my life. Guys like Jim Davis, who was drawing Garfield forever, you know, Akira Toriyama, who did Dragon Ball Z, all of these artists who I grew up with outside of, like monthly comic books, ended up having a huge impact on the way I ended up kind of wanting to take my art.
Yeah, I can see it now. Now that you mention all of those names, even starting off with Matt Kent and Jeff Lemire, guys that are great storytellers, whether they're drawing or not, or illustrating or not. But I can see. You didn't in the beginning, because when I think of Matt Kent and Jeff Lemire, their superhero work that they do for the bigger companies, they rarely ever do any art in it. But their personal work, the stuff that's close to their heart and the stuff that is oftentimes the the benchmark for them is the stuff that they do draw that wouldn't fit into a Marvel or DC world. So were you purposely steering away from superhero-esque type of art?
Yeah, I was in many ways, just because I knew that I wanted to write and draw the stuff that I was working on. Just because of, you know, I had ideas that I wanted to get out there, but also I couldn't afford to hire an artist at the time. So I kind of knew, well, I'm going to have to draw the ideas that I'm having myself, at least right now. And I'm going to have to draw in a way that allows me to kind of, you know, not spend 10 years learning how. Like, I'll have to draw in a way that is realistic for where I'm at right now. And that involved kind of very loose line work, a lot of very sketchy, a sketchy aesthetic to a lot of things. So it was kind of out of necessity that I went in that direction. But I just had so much fun, and I still do have so much fun drawing like that. So I, you know, just kept pursuing it, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I can see that now. And it seems as though, because you were inspired to draw and illustrate a story, you also were honest with yourself of how can I, you know, I'm not going to draw like Neil Adams, if that's what right. I'm waiting for, because that's a lifetime of practice and study and all that stuff. But you were really being honest with what would be the best way there and what would also be fun. And it translates into your work as being very authentic as well, which is it's refreshing to hear these type of stories of where people get their trademark style from. Because now your work, even when you're doing some superhero stuff like the Spider-Man pinups that you do, there was a couple times where I saw it. I said, I would really like to see a Spider-Man book drawn by Sean Daly. Like, you'd be perfect for the character based on the style you did for those pinups. So it's cool to see the type of stories you like to tell, but also where your art has come to. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, thanks, man. That's super cool to hear. It's, you know, you lose track of, well, I do anyways, I lose track of, you know, I wonder sometimes, like, does this look like something I've drawn, or does this have kind of like a signature style to it? And I, you know, it's nice to hear that it does, because I think as a cartoonist and as a comic artist, like, that's the most important thing you can do, is come up with a style that people can look at and be like, oh, I know who this is. I know what this is, you know?
Yeah. So the story that you wanted to tell, that became Terraquill initially.
Yeah. The story that I wanted to tell early on, yeah, that became Terraquill. It was kind of out of necessity in a way, because I was getting ready for my very first fan expo, actually. And originally I was just going to have like prints and just kind of go that route. And then I stopped and I was like, well, this is a comic convention. So to show up without a comic, I don't know, you know, especially at my first one, I don't want to just be there selling artwork. I want to sell comics. And that was, you know, in a big way, the motivation to kind of get Terraquill done was, you know, not wanting to go to a comic convention without comic books.
Yeah, I think based on the answers you say, the reception you received coming into the industry is probably because you entered it with a respect and reverence for it, as opposed to, look at me, I got Batman prints too. Pretty kick-ass, right? You came in and said, let me come with a comic book. Let me create. There's a lot of people here who have worked hard to have a book, and I should too. Which I think is why people were so nice to you, because you were so respectful to the culture of it all.
Why, if you don't care about it, why are you doing it, I guess. It's
right. So the story, I mean, I'm really trying to dig into this story of the Terraquil universe, because when I read the mini comic of Bridge Builder's Creed, I felt it, if that makes any sense. I didn't necessarily understand the universe that I was in because I hadn't read the previous stories, but I felt a certain emotion. I felt the weightiness of this these characters' world, and that there was a message that you didn't outrightly say, but metaphorically you could understand it. It's hard to explain. Was that like what is the message behind Terraquil for you? Like, what's the story you're trying to tell?
You know what? That's I don't even want to to say anything about that, because to me it's more fun when people read it and they tell me what they think I was trying to say.
Okay.
So to kind of give away the mystery of exactly what I was going for, I think does the book a disservice.
Okay.
In a way. So, okay. You know, and that's something I want to like encourage everyone who's ever at a show that I'm at, who's read anything that I've done, is just come up to me and like, you know, even if I have my head down and I'm working, I'm going to be happy to make some time to just like chat about, you know, and answer any, you know, questions you have. But mostly I just want to hear, you know, what did it mean to you? Like, what did you get out of it? And what do you think about it? Because that's really what I find the most interesting after I put a book out, is to just kind of hear, you know, the way people interpreted some of the stories and whatnot. And we've had that conversation before, you and I, actually, when we were, it might have been a couple years ago when we were sitting on the patio having... Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it was one of the restaurants downtown. Yeah, and we were talking about the Bridge Builder's Creed, and you mentioned that you read it, and you had all of these thoughts about what certain things meant to the character, and you were right about everything. It was so interesting and fun to hear you kind of dissect the character and discuss what you thought certain things meant to them, etc. You know.
Well, I'm happy that I was able to understand the. It's always because. I'm not an artist on any level like a lot of you and your peers are and some of my friends, but when I do write, because me and my friend, we do record music together, and when I do write something, I want to fill it with so much information that is very specific and very vague all at the same time, so that you kind of, the hardest trick is for the music to mean something to everybody.
Right.
Or for the story to mean something to everybody. But if we break it down, you can know all the this and the that's and the how everything works, but you also don't want it to mean exactly that in case one day you don't, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's the thing about art. Sometimes, you know, depending on the year that you listen to it, the meaning might change for you, right? You might interpret things a little differently based on where you are in your life and the experiences that you had. It's not going to be something that everybody absorbs the same way or feels the same way about. And that really is one of the coolest, most interesting things about releasing art out into the world, is seeing how the world changes what you've released in, you know, in a few different ways.
Yeah. Yeah, I think for certain type of people who think a certain way, especially those who are in the creative field, they're not as concerned. I mean, they definitely are, because they're human beings. They're not as concerned with the fact of things as much as the meaning and the truth to it. And I think there's a difference between truth and fact. They're interchangeable, but they're very different too. And I think that art, for me, in a creative way, whether it's through podcasting, taking in someone else's art, or trying to create myself, you realize what you need to know. It's not for everybody else. It's not something that's necessarily going to be a collective, but you find out for you what you need to know, that you're in within the art.
Right.
Yeah.
Ideally, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. So the universe, for me, the journey that the characters take, and forgive me, I haven't read Bridge Builder's Creed again. I should have read it. but the memory I have of it kind of reminds me of the same feeling I got reading The Alchemist. I don't know if you ever read that book.
Yes, yeah, it's very good.
And it's that sort of journey of self-discovery, as well as the there's a familial texture to it in Bridge Builder's Creed. And for those who haven't read it, I think you kind of get the same sort of experience of maybe something like a Bone universe, where it's your thing, it's your universe. The characters look like you, and they function and exist in how you've created it to be. If that is that correct? Am I off on that?
Yeah, no, that's very like it's a good way to put it. Actually, you know what? After this, I'll actually send you a PDF of the full version, because I know that you've read the first couple chapters, but I don't think you have the full thing. So I'll make sure that you actually get that after this, if you're interested.
Yes, yes, definitely. Yeah, I just want—I cool. think I just want as many people to back this Kickstarter for you, because your stuff is really good. The Samurai Grandpa, I bought it off of Shane Heron's recommendation. Shout out Shane. Some of the best money I've spent at a con for buying an indie creator's book. It was. You got a good packaged story. Because honestly, a lot of people at cons, they're putting together great stuff, but sometimes the printing costs that they have to eat up themselves, they're selling you a single issue comic for $10.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
You know, so to have a full graphic novel like Samurai Grandpa, and you get a lot of story, it's worth every dollar. So I think I want people to have that same experience.
Yeah, thanks, man. I'm sure Easton appreciates that so much as well. He's the writer for Samurai Grandpa. Yeah, that's you know, it's comics are expensive. Like, they're not cheap to print, really, but that's, you know, kind of one of the things about print media right now. It's just, it's not cheap. Mm-hmm. You know, but yeah, you do what you can.
Yeah. Do you prefer print media, or do you prefer listening to your books or having them on a digital platform? What's your preferred way?
So lately for like prose books, I've been enjoying audiobooks because I can listen to them while I'm working. But for comics, it's probably always just going to be to read them just, you know, in like graphic novel form. I think as much as I love monthly comics, I so would rather read like a collected edition of certain books. It just, you know, I don't mind having to wait out on certain things like that. For me, it's just much more efficient and just a little bit easier to keep track of. I like the way they look on the shelf. There's, you know, a lot of prose that I see from, you know, having like a trade to read. But yeah, at the same time, I love just like going to shows and seeing what, you know, floppies people are putting out, and, you know, seeing like, cause some things you can only get in like single issue, like floppy comics, even like self-printed stuff. So, and I do have a section of my shelf that's just dedicated to stuff like that as well. So, you know, print will always have a place, even if that place, you know, becomes like a more and more inefficient to pay for, it'll still always have a place. And right now, that's kind of like the way I prefer. Do you have a like preferred way to read? Are you digital or what?
I don't know if you can see the video behind me, but that's just my Marvel shelves, and there's an omnibus shelf, and then there's another. People who are listening are like, we can't see what you're talking about. But I'm all about the physical copy. The book.
Yeah, I love, see that. Yeah.
I love flipping the page. I'll read a digital comic. I'll read a digital book. I just got into audiobooks while I'm at work. If I can't find a podcast to listen to, I'm trying to get a couple of actual prose novels under my belt, because I love reading, but I'm so used to reading words and pictures to the point, Sean, and I didn't realize this, but to the point where even when I'm watching TV, I love the subtitles now.
Oh, that's funny. I'm the same way. I like actually prefer subtitles when I'm playing video games and watching movies and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's weird.
And I said to me and my wife, we're watching, oh, it might have been over the holidays, and I said, I need subtitles because it's almost like comic books. Perhaps. Right. I'm not sure if I'm just used to reading words and having the picture kind of blend in with it all. I'm not sure what it is.
For sure.
So.
Well, it seems to be working.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I love making sure I heard the dialogue correctly. I hate missing stuff.
Yeah, I'm the same way.
Yeah.
I hate having to like rewind or just, you know, crank the volume up just so that you can hear what people are saying.
Yeah.
But you know what? I actually think a lot of that comes down to like really proper or improper sound design when people are, you know, working on like certain things. I've noticed a lot of that lately where they're not very good at like making the loud parts quiet and the quiet parts loud enough. It's, you know.
I thought that was always by design.
Being super picky.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't like that feature either. And I feel it's almost somewhat by design, where the way people have their home theaters set up is for all of the action sequences and the music, but the dialogue is always so low.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It is definitely by design. It's just super annoying.
Yeah, it doesn't have me engaged more because of it.
No, for sure. And that's what they're banking on. Like it's funny because like that's what they want, is they want it to catch your attention more, but it's just annoying.
Yeah, maybe because I don't have like that sound bar home theater system to appreciate it and have the speakers distributed right. But even when I'm just watching TV and the commercial comes blaring in after a, you know.
Oh, I hate it.
I hate it. Yeah. No, it's annoying. Hate it. I've said it a couple times in the last year, but during the pandemic, I started to read in larger swaths of a series, so a lot more omnibus reading that I wasn't ever really into before. But it's funny how when you brought up the single issue and then the graphic novel, and then, you know, they come out with these huge collections to have the whole vision put together, how important it is for each of those formats to function well in those formats when you get to that point. Because there's been times where the single issue has been great, and then rereading it, perhaps in a graphic novel, it didn't hit you the same way as a single issue did, or vice versa. Do you ever find that happen to you?
Yeah, I've been there with a certain series. And I think maybe it's just because it's kind of like binging a TV show, where you could watch an episode where something wild happens, and because you have access to the next episode, you're like, oh, on to the next one. Not even going to take a moment to digest and think about what just happened, you know? And so when you're reading in trade, you can kind of do the same thing where you just end up being so excited that you skip to the next one without maybe, you know, taking time to process what you just read. Yeah. And I mean, I do that with prose, like novels when I'm reading them, is, you know, you get to a crazy chapter where something wild happens and you just end up, you know, like last night in the book that I was reading, I was like, one more chapter. I finished the chapter, something wild happened, and I'm like, oh, I'm not waiting around. I'm going to go right into the next one and just like see what happens. So yeah, it's probably like, I imagine something similar there is happening with comics when, you know, we read single issues and, or when we read trades and just like kind of binge them.
Yeah. I've been a fan of each format. I've been a guy going to the store to grab the trade as well as a stack of single issues to read. And, you know, you want to have your finger on the pulse, especially when you, when I started podcasting, I always wanted to kind of know what was happening in the books that were hot and keep up with stuff. And then it got to the point where I'm not a finger on the pulse kind of guy. Like, I'm not trying to make a news site or have the latest news behind the scenes. I just like talking to people. That's been my favorite thing about podcasting is the conversation. So I'd rather read what I want to read and not force myself to read a book because a guy who I've admired is going to be on the show, so I've got to catch up and make sure I have all the questions. It just kind of takes the, I don't know, the fun out of it.
For sure. And like, man, if you're not having fun, you know, why bother? Why bother with anything creative that you're doing?
Yeah.
If you're not enjoying it, then like, you know, I don't understand why.
Take that break. Sometimes you got to take that
break. Yeah, you got to take that break, man. That's it.
Has there been any television shows this year that you particularly liked to kind of distract yourself with?
Oh, God. Nothing right now, to be honest. It's and if I am going to watch something, it's probably going to be from a content creator on YouTube.
Mm.
Which is kind of completely replaced television shows for me right now. I just find that the content that people are putting out on YouTube is like, honestly, it's sometimes like better than a lot of the stuff that I feel like I've seen lately. But also there's just nothing that has pumped me up really and made me want to like jump into it. If anything, there's going to be like some old anime that I want to go back and watch, or like Studio Ghibli movies and stuff. Those are all on my list right now as well. But yeah, other than that, no. What about you? Are you watching anything that I should know about?
In last year, I guess because there was so much more home downtime, you had to find shows to get into. I just finished watching Cobra Kai. Because I was hearing people rave about it, and I was avoiding it because I just was hearing how cheesy it was, and it looked cheesy. Okay. But I gave it at the end of the holidays, the Christmas holidays this year. Me and my wife were home, so at the end of it, we just said, you know what? Let's just watch something where we can kind of shut our brain off and not take too seriously. So we put it on, and before you knew it, I was finished the first season because it was just super cheesy and a lot of fun and everything that I like in, you know, it, Karate Kid. I'm sure you've seen it. We're around the same generation.
I haven't actually. So I'm wondering like, do I have to see it to really get everything out of Cobra Kai? Like, do you think it's required?
You don't, because they show you the, what's the word? The references that give what's happening currently that sort of gravitas. You're supposed to feel like, oh, that's that thing I remember now. But as far as Karate Kid goes, it's just one of those movies that, I don't know, it's a special one. Not so much all the sequels, but the first one is definitely high watermark for 80s movies, I would say.
Cool.
So if you haven't seen it, don't watch. I would say watch Karate Kid, not Cobra Kai.
You're right, yeah.
If you're going to choose one.
Yeah.
But I think it's people's love of Karate Kid that makes them tolerate all the silly, cheesy stuff in Cobra Kai that is almost done purposely. Like, you get it. Yeah. I kind of explained it like, do you remember when we used to watch TV knowing that you were watching a television show? Like, that's TV world. Does that make sense?
In what way?
Like when you watched, I don't know what you watched growing up, but there was those sitcoms, those family sitcoms, like Family Matters and Full House.
Yeah.
Everyone had a car go through their living room at some point.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I know what you mean. It was very just television.
Right. You knew that. Oh my goodness, I can't believe that happened. But you also knew, like, that's a, it could happen, but that's a TV trope.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think that Cobra Kai makes you feel that sort of sensibility again. Like, TV. Remember when TV was TV? Sort of like, the kids are so dumb. Like, this is so cheesy. Clearly they're on TV, sort of thing.
Right.
So it's.
Yeah, yeah.
It's got that sort of feeling to it. I don't know if that's going to discourage you from watching it, but it's just pure 80s bliss.
Yeah, no, not at all. I if especially if that's something that they're actively going for, that just makes it much more fun, I imagine.
Yeah. And then there's those weird moments where they hit you in the heartstrings, and it's like the adult moments can be very touching. You're like, oh, this is this show cheesy, or is this like really nice?
Well, it sounds like they found a good balance of modern storytelling sensibilities mixed with nostalgia to keep, you know, old fans interested.
Yes.
Sounds like a bit of both.
Yeah, it's very funny trick that they pulled. Because even just the fight scenes that they have, you're thinking to yourself, what is this? Is this the am I watching like the Power Rangers fight scene right now?
Right.
These kids suddenly know karate, and you're just, wait a second, I'm watching a television show. Let me just shut up and enjoy it. Right?
Right. Just enjoy it. Turn off for a little bit.
Yeah. Are you still enjoying wrestling right now? Have you been tuning in?
I am, yeah. I haven't watched any of the Big E lately, the WWE stuff, but I've been really enjoying the AEW. They've been doing an amazing job with everything that they're doing recently.
Hmm.
What about you?
I haven't been keeping up with wrestling for a long time, but I love talking about it, and I love the... It's one of those art forms. I call it an art form. Some people say it's silly, but I think it's one of those art forms to me that I understand now why a lot of comic book guys understand wrestling in a way that is not just that young kid in you necessarily. There's a
right.
I like watching or following a lot of wrestling podcasts, hearing about stories and storylines and guys who were, you know, well-known names in the business and kind of hearing their career story. I don't know if you ever listened to Something to Wrestle With.
Love that
podcast. I love the stories behind the scenes stuff that they tell you. So I listen to that frequently. And I always like going back and watching my old favorite matches, but you can really see the workmanship in the guys who really were the best at what they did in a way that you didn't understand as a kid.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, especially as a kid, there's the business, which is all the behind the scenes stuff. Mm-hmm. And then there's the product, which mm-hmm. is what you're seeing on TV. And as a kid, if you're more interested in the product and you're not seeing any of the behind the scenes stuff, which is what I was when I was younger. I didn't know anything that was going on behind the scenes. But the older I got, the more fascinating the business aspect of wrestling became.
Mm-hmm.
And still, even today, I think it's probably the most interesting business I've ever heard of existing. Just the history behind it.
Yeah.
And some of the stories that take place behind the scenes and a lot of these wrestlers' personal stories and journeys and stuff. It's the most fascinating business I've ever, ever learned about. And I probably know nothing about it in the long run. Like there's probably so much more stuff that hasn't been, discussed or talked about. I hope that we one day eventually get a Vince McMahon documentary or a biopic or just something, because, what an interesting person, I guess you could say he seems to be.
Yeah, no, for sure. And when you hear, I mean, I thought he was a hilarious commentator when I was a kid. I always thought Jack Tunney was the boss. For those not initiated in old school wrestling talk, this is when we were, early 90s kids watching wrestling, it was real to us. We knew that perhaps the outcome was decided, but the lines seemed very blurred at the time when you were a little kid.
Yeah.
And you just think that whatever they tell you on TV is what the story is. Little did I know that Vince McMahon was the owner the whole time. And you find out like characters like Million Dollar Man are pretty much based on him.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, that's Mr. McMahon before there was a Mr. McMahon. That's
for sure. Yeah.
It's so interesting. Yeah.
yeah, it's very wild. It's you know, if anybody listening is like, oh God, wrestling, you know, like what, like just look, you know, look up a little bit about the business, especially if you're just interested in super fascinating stories told by very eccentric people. You're going to hear some of the most wild stuff you've ever heard that has taken place in the wrestling business.
Yeah,
and not even that long ago. Like some of the craziest stuff I've heard is stuff that's happened in the last couple of years as well. It's very interesting. And for a while, I wasn't even watching wrestling. I was just paying attention to the stories and like the real life stuff that was happening behind the scenes, because that was way more interesting than anything that they were putting out.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, you can't beat Austin Hart, you know, like there are just matches out there that doesn't matter, you know, what's happening behind the scenes. Like there are just certain matches out there that are kind of like timeless. And that I also think that, you know, even if you don't like wrestling, these are matches that are totally worth, you know, hanging back and checking out at least once in your life.
Yeah, anyone who's heard me talk with you or Mike Ruth or Matthew Klein, Matthew Klein is a guy who works for Valiant Comics, huge wrestling fan, lives in New York City, just loves it. If you guys all got together, it would be quite an episode. everyone who's listened to me talk wrestling knows I'm a Bret Hart mark, and almost to a fault where I keep watching his matches, some of the ones you mentioned. And you go back to that era of very, very gimmicky characters. It's just like comic books, right? You've got these comic book characters with all the pouches and all of the swords. It's just so ridiculous.
Yeah.
And then you had those moments of, is this real? Do they really hate each other? It really seems like they don't like each other. And a guy like Bret Hart wasn't the best interview, but what he did well was make you really think that he meant what he was saying. Like that was the best he could give you. Wasn't going to have a great catchphrase. He wasn't going to have that crowd participation saying what, or, you know, that's the bottom line. But you really like, wow, he really hates his own brother. This seems real.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. It's, but you know, that's how I feel about, Jake Roberts, Jake the Snake.
Absolutely. Like
he was the one who I would just be completely captivated every time he was looking into the camera and talking, just because of the way that he would speak. It's like almost he was like whispering while he was cutting his promos on you. He didn't need to get loud. He didn't need to yell at you. He could look at you and just whisper what he was going to do. And it was terrifying.
It really, you believed him. Yeah, no. And he wrestled in a way that, His finishing move was perfect for his character. It was, there's some guys whose finishing move gets you excited to see it, but his was perfect. Just dropping your head into the canvas or into cement floor. As being the snake man, being the guy who gets you snake bit. It's, there's something to it. I was watching, I think it was Christmas Day. I visited my parents and, WrestleMania 30 was on television. And
WrestleMania 30, sorry, yeah.
It was on the main event. Now, I hadn't seen WrestleMania 30. I knew all the guys in the match. It was the triple threat match with Batista, Randy Orton, and
Daniel Bryan.
And everyone's laughing at me that I've got it on. I'm like, oh, it's WrestleMania 30. Let me see what's happening. And they're all laughing at, you know, the punches looking fake. And, oh, yeah, he's really hurt. And my wife's like, Eric, are we really watching wrestling right now? But by the end of it, they were all captivated.
Oh, that's amazing. That, honestly, like, that is one of my favorite matches of all times, which makes, you know, it's a very good match. It told an amazing story. What captivated them? Did you like ask them like,
that's why I kept it on, Sean, because I said, they're making fun of it now, but if they stick with it and they see a couple of high spots or, you know, a guy just fall out of the ring, they're gonna buy into this. I know they will. And I didn't know the match. I'm not just saying that. I know it's like, you didn't know WrestleMania 30. That's where Daniel Bryan won. I know that he won at a WrestleMania. I just didn't remember when. And I had kind of telegraphed the match to them. I said, so from what I know about wrestling and what I remember, this is going to happen. That move there actually hurt the guy more who gave it than the person who received it. And they were like, but he's being taken out in a stretcher. I'm like, he's going to win. I go, just believe me. This is the story that they're telling, because you can see what the crowd is saying. This is the story that's going to be told. But he's being brought out in a stretcher. He can't move. I said, I think the guy who got the TV in his back, which was Randy Orton, I go, he's probably the most hurt right now.
Right.
And right when the match was going to be done at the end with, I forgot who, I think it was Randy got the RKO. And you had the pinfall, and out of the blue, you see Daniel Bryan fly in with a kick. And then again, he gets tossed out of the ring, and they're like, you really think he's going to win? And of course, you know, the outcome, because we've watched wrestling enough. But man, like you said, the storytelling, it's like a comic book.
It is, yeah, absolutely. It's just, when it's good, it's so good. You know what I mean? It's up there with some of the best books I've read, some of the most interesting comics, some of the best albums. Like, when it's good, it is good. And, I don't know. I wish, like, I hear that a lot as well when I, you know, if I'm at a family gathering and I put on wrestling, it's just, oh, yeah, that must have hurt. Like, look at that. You know, he's not even hitting him. It's like, this isn't a real fight. This is a television show.
Right.
You know, like, this has a story. This is a script. These are athletes. This isn't a... I always find it funny when people say, oh, you know, it's fake, right? It's like, really? Is it fake? I didn't know that. I had no idea.
Yeah. And this is the thing, is that a person who doesn't understand it, like someone such as yourself, they're going to say, ooh, they're going to start wincing before you do. At something.
Yeah.
And they know that the punches are fake, but it's fake. How are they hurting each other if it's fake? That's usually what people say. Like, why would they do that to the guy if it's fake? And I always tell them, I go, listen, the outcome is determined. But what they're going to do to each other in there, if it looks like it hurt, it's because it hurt.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. There's only so many ways. You know, you can fall flat on your back and not, you know, be affected by it. And
yeah.
The answer is, like, there isn't many. Like, if you fall down to that mat, you feel like you've just fallen down on the mat. And I've said this to at least one person, like, if you don't think it hurts, walk out into your backyard on a day when the soil is nice and soft and moist and jump up into the air and land flat on your back. And tell me how that feels, because it's probably going to hurt. And that's a feeling that some of these guys feel, you know, every single night, some of these men and women. That's, it's not like it's flashy and they know what they're doing, which is the only reason they don't kill themselves when they're doing it, but it's going to hurt. It's, you know, it's not as fun as it looks, I guess.
It's always funny when, you say to, I used to, when I was a kid, me and my wife dated since we were 15. This is a very big tangent, but we used to play fight as kids in high school. And so whenever she sees a sharpshooter, she'll always say, ooh, I know that hurts.
Yeah. That's the thing.
Yeah.
It ain't comfy.
No. And whenever she sees a figure four, she goes, oh, I know that hurts too. Because she used to give me a figure four. That was her move to give me.
Oh, man.
So it's just so funny when you see someone watch it. I'm like, yeah, that's not as comfortable as you may think it is just because it's fake.
Exactly. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite finish? Is there a finish that always sticks out to you as, even though I know it's coming, that's just the best?
For me, it would have been the Stone Cold Stunner growing up.
Oh, you're thinking finishing move. I'm talking about a finish to a match.
Oh, like an actual finish of a match.
Yeah.
Well, WrestleMania 30 is one of my all-time favorite finishes. Because you have Michael Cole screaming as loud as he can, tap out Batista. It just set the moment. It was just amazing. It's something I get chills when I watch. And half of that has to do with, you know, the story that they were telling, what was actually happening. But a lot of the credit I also give to the commentators, because they're just as important at telling the story as what you're seeing in the ring sometimes. Another one would have been actually something that was way more recent, which is when Kofi Kingston won the championship at WrestleMania. I think it was 2019, which was just this amazing moment. If you haven't seen it, not WrestleMania. I think that was 2019. And the WrestleMania that we had 2 years ago. I highly recommend going to check that one out, watching that main event and looking at the story that they were telling for that as well. But I mean, other than if I'm thinking further back, Stone Cold and Bret Hart have the best finish that I've ever seen, I think, which was in their, what was it? Was that the match where it wasn't King of the Ring, was it? Do you remember?
Are you referring to WrestleMania? The one where they turn?
Oh, yeah,
the
double turn? It was WrestleMania, yes.
Yeah. The double turn, yeah, that was...
Yeah, the double turn, yeah.
Man.
That was the best finish I think I've ever seen. Just because it was done so well, like, you couldn't have done it better. It was 100. It was 100%, like, the best that could have been done, and they just pulled it off so well.
I don't know if I told you this before, but that was when I met Bret Hart at a Comic-Con, a Toronto Comic-Con a couple years ago. I was thinking of every question as a kid that I wanted to ask him growing up, because I've been since SummerSlam 92, he's been just my favorite character on TV.
Right.
So that I was fine. Like, he was an old man now. He's, you know, clearly he's aged, but I'm just so happy he's still alive. And I said, what do I want to ask this guy? I don't know. I'm like a kid. And I asked him what was his favorite sharpshooter. Like, what was the best?
Oh, cool.
That moment where he couldn't wait to get to that, applying it.
Right.
And it was that one against Stone Cold.
That was the one.
And he said the audio in that building, the way that it's built, it's just perfect for the audience. You really feel it. And he goes, and we just had them at the palm of our hand. And you could just feel the roar in the room every time we did something. And so when I was in that sharpshooter, and I knew that was the best one. And yes, you know what? Anyone who's listening is like, oh, he's talking about Bret Hart again. But what is incredible about him as a performer, I'll say this ad nauseum, is how he was able to switch his style based upon how he, like, just from 96 to 97, his wrestling style shifted. Still very, very technical, but you could tell without knowing the story, he's the bad guy right now. Just from when he wrestled in Canada to the US.
Yeah.
It was so interesting. Or even when he wrestled in Wembley Stadium. To be the character he needed to be in order to put Davey Boy Smith over, he wrestled a certain way, did certain things that just let you know enough of how you were supposed to feel. And I think those subtleties are so lost, but that's the art of it all.
Yeah, he was a master storyteller. And I mean, look at who he learned from, you know? Like, the dynasty that he comes from is just so much history. So much history. It's so, like, just amazing.
Yeah, I look back at him and Owen together and really appreciating what they did on a different level than when I was a kid.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like, when you're a kid watching, it's easy to get caught up in the theatrical, especially watching during the mid-90s. It was very easy to get caught up in the theatrics and the absurdity of how it was all presented, and to kind of lose focus of the actual wrestling. But that's why I like being an adult and looking back at all of this stuff, because just seeing, watching these matches with a different perspective and from a more mature point of view, like, it's art. It's wild. And I never really appreciated that when I was a kid.
Yeah.
You know, I just wanted to watch people get hit with kendo sticks and, just the most ridiculous stuff that you could see at the time. Watching that, isn't it? It's eye-opening. It's super cool to go back and look at it all.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of psychology and build up, just like you would to tie it back into comic books. You build up a certain amount of issues until you get to that payoff point. And that's really what's happening, as silly as it sounds, in these wrestling matches, where you build up for months sometimes. Every week, there's just little aspects of the story that complicate it or make you wonder what's really happening till you get to that payoff moment that oftentimes the crowd is in some way the dictator of what's going to happen, whether it's to upset them or to relieve them. And the psychology that goes into the performance is very, very complex by the guys who are really good at it.
It is, yeah. It's its own form of art. It's, I enjoy wrestling in the same way. This is going to sound odd, but in the same way as I like going to, the theater to see, like a musical, or to the ballet, or,
right,
anything like that, because they're way more similar than... then I think people give them credit for.
That's a very good example, actually, because that's exactly what it is, where you need to be playing off of somebody who is as concerned about making you look good for the sake of the story.
For sure, yeah. It's a dance, and you're putting your life and all of your trust into that person in a wrestling match with them. You're literally trusting your life to that person.
Yeah, I think that's a really good comparison. That and something like figure skating, doubles.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Where, they've predetermined a lot of what it is that they're going to do, but they've got to pull it off.
Yeah, and it's... even something, like figure skating or any of like the Cirque du Soleil and, live action acrobatics and stunt stuff. It's all thrilling for the same reason, and it's all interesting for the same reason. Because really, the ballet and like Cirque du Soleil type stuff, they're all there for the same purpose, which is to tell you a story, which is to come up with a story that's been completely written and scripted, and here it is live, right in front of your eyes. Anything that gets screwed up or anything that isn't supposed to happen, that's part of it. That's part of, being there and seeing it live. And it's quite thrilling, there was a point or a show that a Cirque du Soleil show that I went to not too long ago, like before all this, obviously, and there was a section of the show that involved some of the acrobats getting on top of each other's shoulders and making this big, long tower of people. And they had tried it 3 times, and they had fallen each time. And after the 3rd time, they said, it's live. That's how it goes. We're going to move on to the next thing. And, that's one of the reasons why I love wrestling, actually, is because it's all done live. It's all... something goes wrong, it goes wrong. And that's it. You move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
And it happens a lot.
Yeah. And it's funny, the more you've watched it over the years and you get to kind of know certain performers, they've got their little idiosyncrasies or their spots that they have and they're known for. And you can sometimes see it coming, but even still, you feel it. It's like, I know that this guy does this thing. But every time, he flies off of the ropes into the announcer's table, it always gets me. Or every time, you know, Shawn Michaels would go into the corner and he would, you know, kind of do the flip, or he'd hit it in a way where he bounced off of it, or even Brett used to hit the turnbuckle so hard, like he ran into the wall. He did it in every match, sure. But
yeah,
you believed it.
Yeah, they knew how to work. They were, you know, some of just amazing stuff. And you know, when I was early on, and when I was doing comics, I had actually looked at wrestlers as a huge motivation, because they work what, like 6 days a week, five,
yeah,
something wild. Well, before this pandemic happened, they were having to get on airplanes multiple times a week, or they would have to get into you know, their vans or rental cars and just drive around the country, and then, you know, have to spend all night working. Like they worked in a wild amount, but I just found that super motivating. Like the drive that wrestlers, both professional and independent, need to just to participate in their craft, and you know, as much as everyone else is doing, they just work themselves so intensely. Even them having to eat right and find time to go to the gym and to work out and to, like, you know, keep their minds and bodies healthy, is super motivating. So, you know, I look at wrestlers as a big source of inspiration as well. Funny enough.
No, I get it. It's funny sometimes when you take stock at the things that inspire you, or even the things that take you down a certain road. Like in your case, the person who bought you the art set, who knew that you would be here now in you
know,
getting another Kickstarter ready or having another book. So
absolutely.
It's cool to kind of see what's inspired us or who's kind of pushed us on a different path. So here's a question for you. I'm gonna do a comparison since we did this wrestling talk. If you had to pick between Stone Cold and The Rock, who would it be?
Oh, Stone Cold. Stone Cold for sure.
Stone Cold for sure.
Yeah, just because he was, first of all, he was a great worker. Like, mm-hmm. That guy could work his ass off. He knew what he was doing. In the ring. But just, he was in the best storyline that wrestling has ever had, as far as I'm concerned. It's
a couple. He'll always, a couple of them.
What's that?
He was in a couple of the best.
Of them, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my favorite of all time, I think, is actually Mick Foley. Like, he's, like, when I, just when I look at, like, wrestling as a whole, just for as long as I've been watching it, he was always kind of the guy. Actually, if you want to talk about finishes, the night that he won the world championship for the first time against The Rock.
Yeah. That was a good Raw.
Yeah. Yeah, that was something else. That is a clip worth watching just to hear how loud the audience gets when they know what's happening. It's wild. It's very cool.
Yeah, that was a historic one. I remember watching that as a kid, and to see that such a big title change and historic moment for a guy like him, who was really just your quintessential underdog story, that they did it on a weekly show. They didn't just do it at that was the fun thing about wrestling at one point, was you didn't know when it could happen. You always knew WrestleMania, something big would happen, but there was those times where over the weekend so-and-so won the title in this yeah. this thing, and we got a new, I remember that's how Shawn Michaels won his first IC title. It was, I don't remember it on TV, but it was just, what, he won the change, when did this happen?
That's right. Yes I love when they kind of, and they've done stuff like that recently, actually, funny enough, where they'll just announce it on the website, like, oh, this person just won this title at a live event. I mean, they haven't done that in a year at least, but it's always funny when, like, you know you don't know what to expect, and then something like that happens.
Okay, let's think of another one. Hogan or Ric Flair?
Flair for sure. Yeah. Just because he could actually wrestle, he wasn't. he wasn't just a a sack of meat with a good voice.
Yeah,
which is basically what Hogan was. Like Flair just so entertaining. Yeah, you can just watch his promos over and over again, and it's just like I've laughed and laughed and laughed at Ric Flair promo just because of how absurd they become. Him just stripping in the middle of the ring, and it's just outrageous stuff.
Yeah, well, yeah, he was quite the character. Let's think. I'm trying to think of two guys who you can compare here. Who can we compare? I know your answer to Chris Jericho is always going to be Chris Jericho, so that's no fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, how about Bret and Shawn Michaels?
Man.
No wrong answers.
No, for sure. They're just both so good at different things. Bret was the better wrestler, but Shawn was the better showman. I hate to do this to you, but I'm going to go Shawn Michaels. And I'm going to go Shawn Michaels because he just, if I'm looking at a career, I feel like his career was just better than Bret Hart's. Bret Hart, unfortunately, when he got, concussed and he had to kind of sadly, hang up the boots, it wasn't fair that his career got kind of cut down the way it did. But during that time, we got some Shawn Michaels' best stuff. Like, we got the best stuff that he's ever done in his career. And just watching him, I don't know if you've seen the match where he embarrasses Hogan at SummerSlam. It was one of the SummerSlam matches, but apparently there was some backstage stuff that he didn't agree with. And he ended up just kind of embarrassing Hogan in the ring by overselling everything that he did. He would, take a back body drop and flip flop 12 times out of the ring kind of thing. It was amazing. You have to check this out if you haven't seen it. There's like a super cut of it online, I'm sure. I'll go.
I think that's fair.
Shawn Michaels.
I feel like Shawn Michaels has had two careers.
He has. You're absolutely right.
And I think if I were to compare Shawn and Bret's careers ending in 99, pretty much, I mean, Shawn had his first stop after WrestleMania 14 and he was gone for a few years and Bret didn't last much longer after that. If I were to compare those parts of their careers, I would pick Bret.
Yeah, me too.
In that window.
Absolutely.
When they were contemporaries. But after when Shawn came back, in a way, that might have been even better than the first half.
I think it was. It definitely was, yeah. But, yeah, Bret, everything up until I think he went over to WCW. And even then, even when he was in WCW, he did a few interesting, neat things. His matches were always good, at least.
The storytelling. Yeah, the storytelling part.
Story, but yeah.
Sure. They didn't. Yeah, absolutely. They didn't know what they were doing there, period. Let alone with a guy. It was just a wealth of an overabundance of wealth there in regards to talent that you're gonna be missing out on amazing things because it's just too much.
Yeah, they had no idea. Like no earthly idea what the heck that they should have done with him, and it showed, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah, really. For a lot of their talent.
Yeah.
Okay, let's change it then. If we were to go comic books, Matt Kent or Jeff Lemire?
Oh God, I'm not choosing. That's, no comment on that. They are both just two of like the most amazing, talented cartoonists I've ever had the pleasure of reading. And they're both just also super nice people as well, like very stand-up gentlemen, I suppose.
Yeah, so I like both of those guys as well. I've had the privilege of interviewing Matt Kent. He was me and Martin's first interview.
Oh, cool.
Which was extremely intimidating because I was such a big fan. And I've never been able to get Jeff Lemire because I think he's very careful of the podcast he goes on, which I totally understand. But I'd love to talk to him because I just love – there's so much stuff that he's done just across the board and so much that I haven't read. Like, that's how prolific he's been.
Yeah.
Like, I've never read Essex County.
Oh, that's like
– it's his just, book, right?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And, like, oh, it's so good, too. It's just –
totally.
It'll, yeah, make you feel things. And that's, to me, that's why I read comics is to, you know, I'd much rather read something that breaks my heart than something that makes me laugh or something that makes me, you know, my heart race, basically. It's, and that's what he's good at, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, he's good at many things, but that's one of them.
Yeah. Well, even in his Animal Man, I don't know if you read his Animal Man.
I did. Yes, it was a family book. Like like it was about his family. Like and that's like he can take superheroes and tell, you know, interpersonal stories about them. Really.
Yeah, and exactly.
That's the kind of stuff that I love.
Yeah,
no, especially superhero books.
Yeah, he's definitely a master at getting into the characters. Yep. He could write. I could see him. I would love a Jeff Lemire book, as boring as this may sound to somebody, of the Justice League, of them just talking in the Watchtower or in the Hall of Justice. Like, he would be amazing at just having them talk about what they did on a mission instead of actually seeing the mission.
Yep. I believe he would knock out Job if that was something he chose to do.
Yeah. So why don't we, just before we wrap up, because we've been talking for a bit now, tell everybody about the Kickstarter again.
Yeah, so it's coming out on February 5th is when it's going to be launching at noon. And it's for my new book, The Bridge Builder's Creed, which is, it's going to be 170 pages in total. It might actually, if we're fortunate enough to hit our stretch goals, it'll be a few more pages than that. I'll toss in a whole bunch of extra process stuff in the back, but it's going to be 170 pages, black and white, a full length original story that, it means a lot to me, but I don't really want to talk about why. Like, I would love it if people could read it and then tell me what it means to them. But it is a very personal story to me, and I'm just super excited to finally be sharing it with everybody. Nervous, completely. I'm just a wreck when I think about the launch day coming up, but I'm anxious, I'm excited, I'm worried, I'm happy. It's a mix of many things. So, I hope people will check it out and give it a shot if they're a fan of comics. And the good thing is it's already completely done. I'm not funding money to make it. It's already made. I just need to get it printed. So, that's it.
That's great. I'm really excited for it, and I because you put a lot of heart into it, it's going to have the effect that you want it to have.
I hope so, man. I really appreciate you saying that. That's awesome.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you giving me so much of your time. I didn't realize how long we were talking for. We can probably go on forever, but I'll let you get back to your work. That's it. And
when they're talking about wrestling,
right?
Time flies.
Absolutely. But after the Kickstarter, I'd like to have you back on sooner than later, and we can have another tangential conversation of wrestling and anything else that we want to talk about.
I can't wait. I'm already looking forward to it.
All right, dude. You stay safe, stay healthy, and all the best. February 5th. Let's do it. Everybody, check it out.
Thanks, man. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Don't forget to check out and support John Daly's Kickstarter, February 5th, Bridge Builder's Creed. Thank you for downloading the episode, and we will be back soon.